listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the February 2024 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of Throne of Games by Charlotte Klein. There's been talk inside the paper, even further back, about the possibilities of expanding into games. About a decade ago, Apple CEO Tim Cook gave Mark Thompson, then CEO of The Times, and David Perpich, now publisher of The Athletic, some advice. The Times executives were in the Apple boardroom, demoing the New York Times Now app, a short-lived attempt to attract young readers, NYT Cooking, and the new NYT Crossword app. The Times, said Cook, should really be the leader of digital puzzles, according to a source familiar with the discussion. The Times declined to comment on this meeting. It's undeniable that Wordle was a big tipping point for us, says Hardiman, but it's not Wordle only. It's Wordle driving more attention to other games, allowing us to invest more in games, she says, and ultimately driving attention to the rest of the bundle and to news, too. The number of players engaged with two or more games each week has tripled since the start of 2023. In her 2023 Q2 remarks, Copit-Levien said the audience of people playing games other than Wordle has experienced record growth over the last year. By October, The Times said that the group had more than doubled in size over 12 months. About three-quarters of The Times games audience is in the U.S., with the remainder largely in the U.K., Australia, and Canada. Wordle has skewed more non-U.S. than any of its previous games. The crossword is the only game that's fully paywalled, and yet, for many, the least intellectually accessible, requiring time as well as practice. The Times has been working to make the puzzle less daunting for new solvers, such as with the Easy Mode newsletter, which gives people an easier version of the clues for the Friday crossword, which is among the hardest of the week. Some traditionalists may cry blasphemy at the premise. Making it to Friday is historically an earned achievement. But if we're asking people to pay for a product that's primarily this thing that they can't access, then that's not very smart, says Mason. We're trying to find ways with our editorial content to help people become better solvers, and this is one way, says Knight. There's also the Spelling Bee Forum, the Wordplay Column, the Wordle Review, and now the Connections Companion. Lou, Mason tells me, is currently working on an emoji-only connections board. On the day I visited, they discussed whether they could do a sexy emoji category. Eggplant, peach, tongue, sweat drop. Knight vetoed the idea. He can present very mild and doesn't give a lot of reaction, but I know when he just kind of takes his glasses off, says Mason. He was like, Everdeen, don't do this to me. There are other games in the pipeline, such as a word search game they hope to beta test this year. And there's an interactive editorial quiz that Mason was trying to get off the ground. Basically, our version of the Myers-Briggs test. But it's categories of what kind of puzzle you are, she says. Users will answer multiple-choice questions, and then, using data from the Audience Insights group, be told both their puzzle type and what puzzles, both Times games and others, they should try. Gaming is in the air at the Times. On the day of my field trip to HQ, staffers congregated for a newsroom ping-pong tournament hosted by managing editors Carolyn Ryan and Mark Lacey. I asked Mason what she'd say to people who think the Times' decision-making on games is driven less by a love of their product than the desire to draw in subscribers and revenue. Maybe top executives see games as a cash cow, she says, but I can only speak to the games team as a whole. We love this shit. Ticket to Ride. 60 years ago, history's most influential rock band took the world by storm during their first ever trip to the U.S. As a young photographer, I was with them for the hard days and uproarious nights. Story and photographs by Harry Benson. Opening photos. Upon arriving at New York City's JFK Airport on February 7, 1964, the Beatles, Ringo Starr, Paul McCartney, John Lennon, and George Harrison were met by a media throng. 2 days later, fans rushed toward the band's limo as they headed off for an appearance on The Ed Sullivan Show. January 14, 1964, London. I was ready to head to Kenya in the morning. Then the phone rang. It was my boss, Frank Spooner, the picture editor of the Daily Express. "I'm taking you off the Africa assignment," he said. "We'd like you to go to Paris. The Beatles are on tour there." My heart sank. Yes, I'd heard of the Beatles. They were getting bigger, hit song after hit song. But at 31, I considered myself a serious journalist. As a staff photographer for London's leading daily paper, I'd covered the rise of the Berlin Wall and broken stories in Egypt, northern Rhodesia, and Russia. I was more interested in Kenya's new government than in following around some rock and roll group. "Frank, I'm supposed to go to Africa tomorrow," I told him. "I've had all my shots." Spooner heard me out and rang off. And I thought, great, I dodged a bullet. At the Express, I'd built my reputation on hard news, and no place was more cutthroat than London's Fleet Street, where staff photographers like me fought for scoops tooth and nail against guys on rival papers. I knew that once they put you on a music story, you'd be pegged as a show business photographer. The phone rang again. Spooner had spoken with the top editor. "You're going to Paris," he said. "We think you're perfect for the job. You're presentable. None of our other photographers are good-looking." And that was that. I was off to photograph the Beatles. January 15th, Paris. I met John, Paul, and George at the airport in London. Ringo would join us later. They were friendly and polite and sharp. Barely into their 20s, they joked around a lot and were quite mischievous, which I liked. The band's manager, Brian Epstein, all of 29, knew that photos in the Express would give the group great exposure back in Britain, so they'd agreed to give me full access. I remember John sitting down with me that day and saying, "I know this is good for you, but this is good for us because you're doing our publicity for us. Otherwise, this would cost us a lot of money." My assignment was to wire back one good photograph a day, preferably some kind of exclusive. I was about 10 years older than the Beatles, which earned me some respect. They related to the fact that I was a scruff from Glasgow, a tough town like Liverpool. When we landed in Paris, a member of their entourage pulled me aside and said, "They like you. You're not ugly." Not ugly? Spooner had been right. Physical attractiveness mattered with them. They went to a stylish tailor in Soho, Dougie Millings in the Old Compton Road, who designed their colorless suits. So I fit in. I liked clothes, and I wore a jacket. That night, the band was playing in a music hall outside Paris. Just before they went on stage, I realized I needed another lens. When I went to the car to get it, I heard the first few bars of All My Loving. And it clicked for me, even before I'd seen them perform. Their sound was new. I knew right then I was on the right story. I knew they were going straight to the top. January 16th. We got close, fast. I stayed in the same hotel, the George V. I stayed behind with them when the other journalists left. And you know the main reason these guys were good to me? Because I wanted it. I became not a fly on the wall, but a friend with a camera. I was going to get my pictures. After their second night performing in France, they came back to the hotel at around 10:45. They wanted to go somewhere, but there weren't many places open at that hour. And when they did go out to a club, their table was immediately surrounded by women. They couldn't move. They couldn't dance. Always a swarm. So they usually just stayed in the hotel suite with their handlers and me. They'd smoke cigarettes and play guitar, surrounded by tea sets and coffee pots, vases of flowers, baskets of fruit, newspapers with their pictures in them. I soon saw how the music came naturally. It wasn't like they'd built in time to compose. They had to do it on the fly. There was a piano in Paul's room. At one point, John pulled up a chair and started tinkering. Paul joined in. John started humming what I would later recognize as the tune to "Baby's Good to Me, You Know. She's Happy as Can Be, You Know. She Said So." But they got stuck. Where should it go after the melody? George wandered over with his guitar and played a catchy rhythm and blues riff, plucking away. He seemed to be improvising. Although John was later credited with writing the riff, influenced by Bobby Parker's song "Watch Your Step," the way I heard it that day was George coming up with it. They appeared to be writing a song right in front of me, And as John and Paul kept at it on the piano, Ringo, in a black turtleneck, came over and stood next to George. And I had my shot. The Beatles composing I Feel Fine. Next photos, Paul, photographer Harry Benson, Ringo, and George, captured by John, who borrowed Benson's camera. And the Beatles manager, Brian Epstein, 29, who kept his cool amid the Beatlemania frenzy. January 17th. They usually got up late. One day, they were still in pajamas and robes, when one of their road managers, Neil Aspinall, or Mal Evans, came in with a big sack of mail. Word had gotten out that the band was staying at the George V, so cards and letters were piling up. The four of them sat on the rug, reading them out loud. "I've always thought you were the cutest Beatle." Stuff like that. They'd rib each other. I got down on the floor, photographing, and noticed Paul had positioned himself right in the center, reading a letter. He knew instinctively how to play to a camera. He would even marry a photographer, his first wife, Linda Eastman. The picture editors at the Express understood Paul's magnetism. He was the handsomest, and you looked at him right away. As a photographer, you could have two or three Beatles in a shot, but you always had to have Paul. My instructions from the picture desk would be sure you get Paul in the picture, old boy. Ringo got the most mail, though, by far. I think that's because girls thought he was the most approachable. You couldn't go for Paul or John or George. They were also good-looking. Plus, John was married. If a fan was going to choose, she chose the one she thought the other fans weren't going after. That evening, they knocked about in the suite again. But my day didn't end when the Beatles' day ended. Every night, I'd stay up in my hotel bathroom, developing and printing pictures so the Express could pick one to run in the paper. I'd use gaffer's tape to seal any openings around the door, wedge towels under the door, and put a bed sheet on the floor to kneel on. In the pitch dark, I'd put the exposed rolls of black and white film in little tanks with D76 developer, usually spilling developer all over the place. I'd hang the rolls of negatives on the shower rack to dry. I ruined more toilets developing my photographs than I can count. I'd then put my enlarger on the commode. I'd choose the best frames, print them wet, then fix them with a fixer in a small tank. When you flipped the light on, you'd see a hellish mess. Your hands and the bed sheet stained yellow. You used the bathtub to wash the prints and negatives, drying them with a hairdryer. By then, it'd be 5 a.m. You'd set up a transmitter and attach it to the bedroom phone and send three or four selects. It would take about 8 minutes to transmit each picture. Next photo, George, lounging in bed at the George V Hotel in Paris. On a couple of evenings, he shared a room with Benson. I'd spend part of every night in my underwear, on my kneecaps, sweating in a sealed-off bathroom, but I'd feel rather pleased with myself for what I'd done that day. January 18th. Brian Epstein was a gentleman. He spoke like he came from Eton or Oxford. If people made requests nicely, it wasn't in him to say no. Epstein would let in even local reporters from the provinces. He knew there was promotional value if someone posed with the group, and then his hometown paper printed a shot, calling their own guy the fifth Beatle. Epstein loved the Beatles, and they loved him. It was Epstein who chose their matching outfits. He was adamant about a fresh, clean look. He wanted their boots to be spotless. Men with long hair were considered controversial at the time, and at the beginning, their hair was slicked back. Then, all of a sudden, it's cut sharp and smart with a fringe. They even kept their hotel rooms neat. Before they went out, they'd smooth out the beds. They didn't want to be known as untidy, leaving towels or liquor bottles strewn about. They discussed that. They certainly were the first and last rock group to do this. It would soon become a badge of honor for other bands to trash their room. Epstein was ready for anything. The first sign of serious trouble, he could call big-time lawyers in his family or associated with them, people you didn't want to get a phone call from. If a problem came up, he knew how to make it go away. He was always saying, "Don't worry, Harry, it'll all work out." And he'd say it so calmly while all the madness was swirling around him. From dawn till late at night, Epstein focused on the Beatles. But sometimes he'd just not be around. He would have a boyfriend with him, and then he'd sort of disappear. And after many of the shows, the nights could drag on until 3 in the morning. Young women fans would occasionally come up and sit in the rooms and have a party. The Beatles would pick up the phone and order food, a lot of it not being touched. They were like soldiers on leave. They were so young, they had no filter. George was 20, Paul, 21, John and Ringo, 23. At the 50th anniversary celebration of their stay at the George V, I was asked what the Beatles learned when they were in Paris. I thought for a moment and answered, they learned to order room service. They discovered they could call up for bottles of whiskey, too. But they didn't know how to drink, really, just a little here and there. I never saw them drunk. I never saw drugs either. This was before the drug scene impacted them. Epstein would die 3 years later of an overdose of drugs and alcohol at age 32, and his loss was devastating to the band. What I did see were a lot of young women, as you'd see with many music groups. I shared a room with George a couple of nights in Paris and New York, with George sleeping in the second bed. John did this too on a later assignment I did with the band. Because the one they are supposed to be sharing a room with, I'm not saying who, has got a girl in the next bed. So they roomed with me. That's the truth. January 19th, 2 a.m. A day or two into the Paris trip, we were all having a drink, and George said, "That sure was some pillow fight we had the other night." My ears perked up. A pillow fight? But there was another newspaper guy sitting there. I'm thinking, I know the bastards heard this, so I register it in my head for when I've got the four of them alone. I file it away and let a few nights pass. It was 2 in the morning, just me and the Beatles in John's room. Everyone else had left. They were in their night clothes. They'd ordered up food and whiskey. And Epstein came in. He had big news. "I Want to Hold Your Hand" just made it onto the charts in the U.S. They erupted in cackles. They were beaming. Then he put the icing on the cake. And next month, we're off to America. You're going to be on the Ed Sullivan Show. The song had just entered the Billboard 100 at number 45. By February 1st, it would climb to number 1. So, I saw my opening. I suggested they celebrate with a pillow fight, like the one George had mentioned. John immediately shot it down. "No, it'll make us look silly." But I kept my eye on John, who started slinking off. And just as I lifted my camera, John sneaked up behind Paul and, pow, whacked him in the head with a pillow. Paul's drink went flying, and they were off. They went at it, quite vicious, letting off steam. If one went down, the others would pile on, like dogs fighting over a scrap of meat. Paul was smacked down, dazed, and John went right behind him, bang, back and forth. Paul got the worst of it. 2 rolls of Tri-X 120 film later, a total of 23 frames and 1 blank, they were exhausted. In one frame, 3 of them were in midair above Paul on the bed, and they were in a perfect tumble of pajamas and pillows, and I got it, a kind of waterfall of Beatles. I was using a Rolleiflex 120, which has a 2.25-inch negative, so it's pin-sharp clarity, with depth running through the blacks and whites. I knew it as I photographed. This was what I'd come for, the number one rock and roll band in the world, having a pillow fight. I've been a photographer for 70 years, and the pillow fight is one of my favorite photos. It's a fun picture. It has access. It has intensity and fame and pure joy. And irony, grown men in their pajamas acting like kids. It shows the greatest band in history at their giddiest moment of greatness, and it can never be repeated. But most of all, I love it because it didn't just mean the Beatles were going to America, it meant that I was going with them. February 7th, 1964, Pan Am Flight 101. To me, New York was the big time. From the moment I arrived, I began to think, maybe I could actually stay in America and never come back. It's important to remember the mood of the U.S. in the winter of 1964. The Beatles didn't only need America, America needed the Beatles. President John F. Kennedy had been assassinated less than 3 months before. The country was still in mourning. The civil rights struggle was in full force. Russia and America were in a Cold War. The nation needed something uplifting. So here was this bright, positive group with the promise of youth, representing Britain and Europe, bringing sympathy for the loss of a young American president whom I'd photographed in 1961 in London and Paris. To be honest, though, I wasn't really thinking about the Cold War. I was thinking about the next Beatles job. I delivered for the Express, and I didn't want any other photographer going to America. The Express didn't need convincing. The editors persuaded Epstein to let me stick with the band for the U.S. tour. The paper had a lot of muscle, all kinds of connections, and I made sure I was on the inside before the band even stepped off the plane in America. Which is how I got on Pan Am Flight 101, departing Heathrow, bound for John F. Kennedy Airport, which had gotten its new name 6 weeks before. The Beatles had curtained off first class, but I was also in first class, because board members of the Express were on the board of British Airways. They'd arranged with Pan Am for me to have a seat up front, too. It was the Beatles, Epstein, John's wife Cynthia, and me. Many of the economy seats were filled with journalists from the Times and the Mirror and the Mail, coming over to cover the arrival, the British invasion, the Beatles, Storm America. A couple of times, the music producer Phil Spector, who'd booked a seat, made his way into first class. He stood there, chatting up Epstein. You can see him on my contact sheets. The Beatles knew he was a big shot, but they wanted privacy, and Epstein didn't want someone, especially a producer, bothering the band. So the flight attendant sent him back to coach. As we landed, I was sitting with John. We looked out the window and saw a huge gathering of photographers in a press area behind barricades. One of them, Ken Regan, who would later become a friend, had a black pompadour-style hairdo, and John pointed, "Look, there's Elvis, come to greet us." John was anxious, though, like all the Beatles, about what to expect. Would the American media be tough on them, or misconstrue something they said in an interview? Would demonstrators, because of all the press on hand, use the opportunity to stage some kind of protest? As the plane taxied in, John and I saw a mob lining the terminal rooftop, but it was a mob of fans waving and screaming hysterically. They were being serenaded. You could hear the crowd singing, "She loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah." It was a love fest. On the flight over, I'd proposed a photo idea, which the Beatles liked. I would be the fifth person off the plane, and as the band got halfway down the boarding stairs, they'd turn back and look at me, and I'd photograph them with the press, the crowd, and the New York skyline in the background. The picture would say, literally, "Beatles come to America." But in my mind, it also said, Benson got a picture no one else was in a position to take. So we exited the plane. George, then John, Paul, Ringo, then me. And they got so distracted they forgot to turn around. They were caught up in this chaotic drama. The crowd was screaming. The press was screaming, "Look here." It was deafening. I just grabbed Ringo's coat and shouted, "Turn around!" And he hollered at the others, and they all looked back, Paul waving. "Bingo! Thank you, Ringo." I fired off 3 frames. One shot ran in the Express the next day under the headline, Crazy. That's New York as the Beatles arrive. February 8th, Manhattan. Our second day in New York, we went to the CBS TV studio for a rehearsal. Ed Sullivan was the host of the most popular variety show on television. He was deferential and obliging. He even put on a Beatles wig as a joke. They were soaking up the attention. Everywhere we went, in restaurants, passing a bar, there was Beatles music playing. But they never allowed themselves to get a swelled head. We usually just sat around at the plaza. As I had done in Paris, I stayed on the same floor as the band. Fact, when you have good-looking guys and their records number one, you have girls fighting to get onto the elevators and the back stairwells to get onto the 12th floor. Fact, a couple of girls snuck in and jumped on their beds and security had to take them away. This was rock and roll. Elvis Presley, same thing. But it was a big problem for Epstein because he didn't want any incident to happen on his watch. He would discuss this with me. We must watch this. We're introducing young girls to the Beatles, and we're responsible. I began to understand how the band interacted. As I saw it, Paul was the leader. He seemed the most sophisticated, most business-minded, thinking about their image. He was upbeat and encouraging. John was a leader in other ways, on other days. He was the conscience of the group, certainly. Creatively, you sensed John and Paul were in charge, insisting, "This is what we do." Together, they had the last word. John was a thoroughly decent guy. He was the most sensitive of the four, never wanting to insult anyone. At one of the New York dinners, someone was singing the national anthem, and a member of the party made a sarcastic remark about the singer's delivery. John scolded him, "Be quiet." He didn't want this stranger to be associated with the Beatles, and the Beatles, by association, to be seen as disrespectful, especially over the national anthem. George was very serious and thoughtful. He was secretly impatient, I'd say, with all the bowing and scraping, but he was always courteous, to the point where if the band would rush past a group of fans, he'd go back and apologize for how they got caught up in the moment. One night, I went with George to Coney Island, just the two of us. George was sort of homesick. I was alone, too. He wanted to see a part of America that was different. But Coney Island? It was February, 8 at night, with only one or two places open. It was drab and disappointing. We might as well have been in Bournemouth. Ringo was accommodating, funny, even-keeled. He was part of the formula that made them a success, and he actually became an anchor for the band, on stage and off. Whenever there was tension, Ringo brought composure. In New York, I learned how Ringo had come into the band in the first place. Pete Best had been the drummer in the early Beatles. His mother, Mona Best, had opened the Casbah Coffee Club in Liverpool, where the band played some of their first gigs. But as they became successful, the word was that she'd become overbearing and supposedly kept bugging Epstein about Pete's band. And for this and other reasons, apparently, Epstein and the Beatles let Pete go. And up pops Ringo. February 9th. The main event was their Sunday appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show. This was the epicenter of Beatlemania. That day, London had been on the phone, hounding me to send my pictures as soon as the show was over. As the band was leaving the plaza to get into the limo, there was a pack of screaming people. Previously, the Beatles had always made sure to squeeze me into their car, but this was mayhem. Any other car would have just left. And yet, Paul held the door open so that I could get in with my cameras. At first, I was sitting on the floor, literally. Then we started lurching down the street, and I managed to get up and sit on John's lap. I was worried about one thing. How am I going to take photos and focus? I decided to concentrate on faces and bodies out the side windows as people peered in, surging toward us, shouting, waving. Old men in overcoats, high school girls, policemen, click, click, click. Pictures from inside the fishbowl of the crush outside. This was a prelude to similar scenes in the movie A Hard Day's Night, which would come out 6 months later in America. The pandemonium wasn't unprecedented, of course. Fans had mobbed Valentino and Sinatra, and Elvis in particular. I'd seen this with musicians and movie stars, but never at this level. Next photos, Benson's iconic Paris photograph, Beatles Pillow Fight, one of 23 frames he made the night the group learned their song, I Want to Hold Your Hand, had entered the U.S. charts. The audience at the Ed Sullivan Show before the Beatles took the stage at CBS TV Studio 50. When we got to the theater, I stood behind the TV cameramen taking pictures. Once it was showtime, the Beatles were all business. The audience was deafening, but these four were pros. They stuck to the set list, All My Loving, Till There Was You, She Loves You, and Then I Saw Her Standing There, and I Want to Hold Your Hand. All love songs. They wanted people to like them. They also understood that they were representing their country and the Queen. Buckingham Palace had passed along a message, very quietly, that they were good ambassadors for Britain, and they wanted to assume that role. The broadcast turned out to be a milestone in American culture, bigger than they could have ever imagined the night of the pillow fight. 73 million people watched. The band's popularity exploded. This was a magnitude of fame that had been reserved for heads of state or heavyweight boxers. Now they were the heavyweight champions of the world. It took me many years to get it through my head, but what the Beatles had done was remarkable, taking the essence of Buddy Holly and Chuck Berry and the Everly Brothers and making it global. As time went on, people began to say their songs would be played for centuries. That stuck with me. I started to realize my photographs would be valued for centuries, too. I hadn't been shooting rock stars. I'd been photographing history. Final photograph shows the Beatles romping on the beach. Postscript, February 11th to the 18th. After New York, we went to Washington, D.C. It was snowing. They were cold. I was cold. I was wearing just an ordinary pair of shoes. Washington was a scene. The Beatles had gone to the British Embassy, and the guest got out of hand. Someone had even snipped a lock of Ringo's hair. I was grateful we were headed to Miami. The Beatles relaxed by the pool at the Deauville Hotel. They took a trip on someone's yacht. They made another appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show, this time broadcast from their hotel. I even arranged for the band to meet and pose with Muhammad Ali, then known as Cassius Clay, who was in Florida to fight Sonny Liston for the world heavyweight boxing title. But that's another story for another time. A few months ago, I came across a photo from that week, one that I'd never printed in a large format before. I'd wanted them on the beach, kind of letting loose, and I made a print. In it, you see the four Beatles running through the surf, looking really young, like teenagers, on holiday. Behind them, women are standing in the waves. The Beatles seem to be carefree, splashing into the future. That's how I felt. Within a year, I would move to Manhattan, and I stayed for 60 years and counting. I was the fifth off that plane, and I've never looked back. late bloomer. 30 years ago, after David Letterman decamped to CBS, NBC made an historic decision to give Late Night to a nobody, an oral history of Conan O'Brien's tumultuous and hilarious first year by Andrew Buss, with opening illustration by Mike Toffanelli, which shows Conan O'Brien on the set, along with David Letterman, Sarah Silverman, Robert Smigel, Lisa Kudrow, Max Weinberg, Bob Odenkirk, Janine Garofalo, Lorne Michaels, and Andy Richter. If you tuned in to NBC at 12:35 a.m. on September 13, 1993, you witnessed late-night history in the making. Jay Leno had inherited The Tonight Show from Johnny Carson in 1992, and a deeply pissed-off David Letterman had decamped to CBS. That meant a new host for Late Night had to be found. NBC turned to Lorne Michaels, who tapped 30-year-old Conan O'Brien. When NBC announced the identity of the man who would take over their decade-old franchise, TV critics, audiences, and even Letterman himself had the same question. Who? O'Brien, now regarded as one of the best hosts in the medium, one who spent nearly 30 years on the air, had minimal on-camera experience when he landed the job. As he once quipped to a journalist who'd called him a relative unknown, "Sir, I am a complete unknown." To be fair, O'Brien had already been one of the era's sharpest comedy writers, working on Not Necessarily the News, Saturday Night Live, and The Simpsons, not to mention spending 2 years as the president of the Harvard Lampoon. Those who witnessed his high-energy pitches in writers' rooms were already aware of how brilliant he was. Now, everybody and in every living room in America just had to agree. NBC suggested that Letterman not be mentioned in the inaugural episode on September 13th, but O'Brien knew that was absurd. He, his head writer, Robert Smigel, and his team found the perfect way to address this head-on. The cold opening found O'Brien walking down the street cheerily, as everyone he encountered greeted him with a similar refrain, "You better be as good as Letterman." Then O'Brien retreated to his dressing room and, while whistling, prepared a noose to hang himself before a crew member informed him that it was time to go on. That's how Conan O'Brien introduced himself to the world. The opening let audiences know what they were in for: silliness with splashes of intellectualism and edginess, plus a final coating of self-deprecation. It was a far cry from Letterman's beautifully constructed sardonic style or Leno's more traditional desk jockeying. It was a new show for a new generation. To mark the show's 30th anniversary, Vanity Fair spoke to O'Brien and many of those in his orbit about that wild first year. Lorne Michaels, executive producer, Late Night with Conan O'Brien. "There was a group of us who wanted Letterman to host The Tonight Show instead of Leno. David decided to go to CBS, and I got a call from NBC President Bob Wright, who said that they were going to announce that I was producing the new Late Night Show." David Letterman, host, Late Night with David Letterman. "I remember in that overlap transitional period, there was so much attention to the change. Is he going to stay? Is he going to leave? In the beginning, it was kind of exciting, and then I soon sickened of the attention because I was unaccustomed to it. It really began to be superficial, and I felt my ego had been set on fire, and I can't possibly stand it anymore." Michaels, "Everyone who had been in Late Night was a baby boomer. I think it was, who do we know in the 28 to 35 group? We looked at a bunch of people, and I talked to Conan about being the head writer on it." Robert Smigel, head writer, Conan O'Brien. "Conan joined Lorne in the pursuit of finding the right host. He went out to dinner with various people. The more he did, the more he thought, these guys are great, but I kind of think I could do it." Lisa Kudrow, close friend of O'Brien's and early guest Conan O'Brien. Conan was spending time looking for who the host would be. He knew he wanted to do a show that was not just celebrity interviews, but hosted by someone who knew enough and who read enough to ask intelligent questions of scientists or authors or other people too. And I said, "So it sounds like you want you." And he said, "That would never happen." O'Brien had been thinking about what he wanted to do next in his career. The logical next step was shifting from writing to performing. He told Michaels he was bowing out of the head writer role, and the network brass at the time continued to search for a host without him. Michaels, producer Jeff Ross, president of NBC's West Coast division Don Ohlmeyer, president of NBC Entertainment Warren Littlefield, and executive vice president of late night and special programming Rick Ludwin, headed for the Hollywood Improv one night in April to scout talent. They didn't see anyone they were ecstatic about. The next day, they met in Ohlmeyer's office. Jeff Ross, producer, Conan O'Brien. Lorne brings up Conan's name and says, "Well, Conan, maybe, could host it." And the NBC guys were going, "You think?" I remember Lorne turned to me, not knowing that I had never met Conan, and goes, "You think?" And I go, "Maybe." Then NBC said, "Can we test him?" Lorne turns to me and says, "Jeff, can we test him?" And I was like, "Sure." Michaels, the more that I spent time with him, the more I started to see it. I thought he had the intelligence. In a small room, he was truly funny and fast. So I thought more and more that he could do that. Conan O'Brien, host. There isn't another person in show business who could have said, "I have an idea. He's a writer on The Simpsons. But he's got a good look, and I bet in time he'd be a good host." No other effing person in show business could have said that. Smigel, I was excited for him, but I was scared. I remember saying to him, "Man, this is a tough way to get on TV." I wasn't the best person to rev him up in that way. As much as I wanted him to make it, I just reacted honestly. But he said, "If I get this, I really want you to be the head writer." With short notice, O'Brien's team managed to get Mimi Rogers and Jason Alexander as guests for his audition, and he won the crowd over when he told Rogers, "People always say that it's tough to be a model. Turning a big crank is tough." The joke helped get O'Brien support within NBC. O'Brien, the audition was fun because I had nothing to lose. The minute I got out there and there was an audience and I got to sit behind the desk, I loved it. It felt very much like the linguine meeting marinara sauce for the first time. Smigel, after that, my confidence went completely in the other direction, like, "He's going to be enormous. I can't believe how big our show's going to be." O'Brien, you could say I had more confidence in the audition than I had in the actual show for the first year. Even though O'Brien had impressed NBC, they were still thinking about going with Gary Shandling instead. O'Brien, Lorne Michaels called me and said, "You're not going to get it. It's going to go to Gary Shandling. Shandling's going to do 12:30. I hung up, and I remember saying to Lisa Kudrow what I had just heard, and I said, "Yeah, I don't see it. Gary's a peer of Dave's." And at the time, he was doing the Larry Sanders Show. He's getting all this critical praise for making this amazing show that satirizes the form. I don't see him going in and doing Monday through Friday. Kudrow, I don't know how much we talked about it. I just knew. You're trying to replace David Letterman. No one replaces David Letterman. You're no one. And here she laughs. It can't be anybody that an audience would know. Sure enough, Shandling was out. The show went to the underdog. O'Brien, it is a moment that is seared in my memory. It's the day of a recording of a Simpsons episode. We're all sitting around a table when someone in the room said, "Conan, there's a phone call for you." And I went up and got on the phone, and it was my agent at the time, Gavin Pallone. And in a quiet, calm voice, he said, "You've got 12:30. Ross, I went out to lunch, and my assistant handed me all my messages, and it's like Rick Ludwin, Lorne Michaels. The names made me look at this and go, oh my God, he got it. Letterman, I didn't know what he looked like. I didn't know what he sounded like. I didn't know anything about him. So my reaction to Conan behind that desk was similar to everyone's reaction, which was, now, who is this? Why is this guy here? Who will be the real host? Immediately after giving him the job, NBC had O'Brien rush to Burbank to appear on that night's episode of The Tonight Show so Leno could introduce him to America. The next task became figuring out what on earth the show would actually be like. O'Brien, we didn't have much time. I get selected in April, and I don't really get to start working on the show until late May. Smigel, we idolized Letterman, which affected a lot of my approach. I was desperate to do anything Letterman didn't do. O'Brien, first there was Carson. Then there comes, for our generation, Letterman, who is ironic. Then we thought, okay, what comes after that? It needs to be more cartoony. The performances can't be a wink and a nod. This has to be a new thing. This has to be postmodern. And I think what we ended up with was, it's got to have elements of SCTV and Pee-wee's Playhouse. We had all of these very strong, almost religious, beliefs about what this needed to be. Smigel, I said, do we have to call it late night? Can it just be a brand new show so it doesn't feel like we're stepping into Letterman's shoes? O'Brien, if it was late night with David Letterman and then we called it something else, maybe that would help lessen any comparisons between me and Dave. Smigel, I suggested Nighty Night. Conan liked that a lot because it felt appropriately silly for his personality. And then, oddly enough, Lorne Michaels came to us and had the same notion that we should change the name of the show. His idea was calling it Night Night, which I thought was better than Nighty Night because it wasn't silly in an alienating way. O'Brien, I remember us going and pitching this idea to Rick Ludwin. We say to him, okay, we don't call it Late Night because we'll be compared to Letterman. We call it Nighty Night or Night Night with Conan O'Brien. And then he just cut us off and went, well, let me tell you something. Late Night has been a very lucrative franchise for us. It has existed for 11 and a half years under David Letterman. We have three franchises. The Tonight Show, which began in 1955 and has had multiple hosts. We could see that happening with this franchise, Late Night, and there is no way in God's green earth that you are changing our franchise. In addition to Smigel, producer Jeff Ross became an integral part of the team. O'Brien, Jeff Ross is just a perfect producer for me. He's really good at making it happen. Jeff's heart beats once every 9 minutes. He works at that temperature that really helps work with me and offset my madness. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.